I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. If you're a regular listener, you know that we occasionally invite booksellers on to offer reading recommendations. One book title we've been hearing repeatedly is The Correspondent by Virginia Evans, which was released this past April. In fact, our book critic Suzanne Perez reviewed the novel on our show a few weeks ago, calling it the theoretical book of the year. It's a novel told in letters to and from a woman named Sybil, now in her 70s. We recently reached out to Evans to talk about this novel that continues to gain momentum. Here's our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. And can you give our listeners a description of The Correspondent?
The Correspondent is a book about a woman. When you start the book, she's in her early 70s. And the book is really a portrait of her life that you weave together through letters that she sends and receives. The whole book is told through these letters or emails that she is writing or receiving from her corresponding partners or from, you know, strangers or famous people or different people that she interacts with. You know, you begin at this moment in her life that she describes as the winter of her life, but through the book, you sort of get the backstory, and then you are also living through this era of her life, which you think will be winding down, like her life will be winding down, but it's actually not really winding down at all. It's sort of opening up. And so I think at the end of the book, what you have is a portrait of her whole life, sort of beginning to end, but told in a sort of putting a puzzle together kind of way, I think is how I would describe it.
So how did you come up with the idea for Sybil? Does she have an origin story? Because I'm looking at you. Our listeners cannot see you, but you are a very young woman, and Sybil is in her 70s, almost 80, if I remember right. So how did you as a young woman get into that mindset of an older woman? And I guess, you know, back to the question, does she have an origin story for you?
You know, it's funny how many people ask me this question, sort of how did you get into the mind of a woman in her 70s and 80s? And so I've had a chance to give it a lot of thought. And I think when I was writing the book, okay, I'll say Elizabeth Strout, one time I heard this interview where she said that the voice of Olive Kitteridge arrived. I think she said she was like loading the dishwasher or unloading the dishwasher, and sort of this voice of Olive Kitteridge arrived. And I remember hearing her saying that and thinking, that's how I felt about Sybil. Like, I kind of felt like she just arrived and was here with me, sort of over my shoulder. Her voice, which is pretty unique, her sort of personality, her way of interacting with people, she's very blunt, she's very direct, she's very smart, you know, she's very opinionated. And that whole package of who she was arrived sort of on my shoulder. And then I felt it was fairly natural for me to get into the river of her thinking and speaking and writing as I was writing the book. And I think part of that is probably because I have spent my lifetime enjoying and valuing relationships with older people, you know, people in my family and people I've worked for and worked with and people I've met along the way. I've always found that having relationships with people older than me has been really valuable and something I've enjoyed so much during my life. I've been that way since I was a child. I've just always really enjoyed having relationships with people older than me. And so I think almost data gathering, I think maybe as novelists, we're sort of always data gathering or story gathering or, you know, moving through the world in this way of acquiring tidbits of thought or life experience or story, throwing them into this big pit of inside of us. And then when you go to write a novel or a story, you're sort of pulling out of the pit. What's down there? What do I have? What can work in this story? And so she really did feel accessible to me. I did meet a woman around the time I was starting to think about writing a new novel who sparked the idea of Sybil. I met this woman. I was trying to buy her house. And so I went to her house to kind of, she took me on a tour of her house. And it was a sort of first idea of you walk into someone's house and you have this experience of saying, oh, I had no idea, you know, what's on their walls and what pictures and what, you know, things they have. That was part of it. And, you know, when I was pulling some of Sybil's thoughts together, sometimes I would lean into my mother-in-law, and she has a similar kind of disposition and personality to Sybil in a great way. I'm very close with her. And so that is a relationship that is strong and big in my life. And so I was able to kind of pull from that. Sometimes I would think, what would Joyce say? Joyce is my mother-in-law. And then that would help me find my way with Sybil. But yeah, mostly imagination, but also, pulling out of that pit, out of my own, experiences.
I also have a Joyce, and she reminded me a lot of her. So Sybil experiences so much life, joys and heartbreaks alike, all, throughout the last decade or so of her life, like you mentioned. And I'm wondering, I guess this maybe is a question about craft. Did you start with the idea of what Sybil's life looks like now and then move backward into like creating her backstory? Did you start with only the letters she had written? I mean, talk to me a little bit about your process.
Yeah, it's so funny because I'm thinking back, like, how did I do this? I know when I started, I had Sybil, this woman in her 70s who was alone, but so much had come before. She had children, she had had a marriage, she had had a big career, she had had a whole life. But now, where you find her kind of making the incision in time, which is something Claire Keegan, I was in school with Claire Keegan, and she says you make an incision in time. And so the incision in time is that she's 73 or 4 or whatever she is. And that's the moment of entry. But I knew that the woman I had was a complicated, intelligent, full person. But what you saw from sort of the first snap was an older lady alone. And so that was kind of what I was working with. And what excited me about writing the story was fleshing out what had come before and what was still going to happen. I remember when I sat down to start, I knew she had lost a child young, and I knew she had had this vibrant career. Those were sort of the things that I had intact about her. And I had her voice, I think. I think I sort of knew what sort of a woman she was, which, may we all be so blessed to have a Joyce, but, somebody who's honest and loving, very honest and very loving. And so that was where I started. And I think I really did kind of build the thing brick by brick, letter by letter. The first letter in the book was the first letter of my first draft, this letter she writes to her brother. And so, the engine of the story felt like, to me, for the reader, for the reading experience, what's the story? You sort of asking yourself, what's the story? What happened here? What came before? Because there's all these indications that things have happened in her life, and something about the story makes you want to know. Something about caring about her, I guess. You want to know what happened before. This is my eighth novel, and I've always said writing a novel is like, for me, the first draft or sort of the beginning or the first sort of act as the writer is you take this big blob of wet clay and you throw it on the wheel. And that's the beginning. Whatever you're kind of working with, whatever kind of first draft attempts you have, that's the beginning. At least that's how I work. I think other people probably have a more elegant way of doing it. But for me, it's you throw this big wet thing on, but then through the process and through building the story and through revision and through the way the story changes over time, you're sort of drawing up the sides of the clay and making the pot. You're pulling it up, and you're pushing your thumbs in, and you're raising the sides, and you're digging your hands down, and all the while you're spinning this wheel, and you're kind of making it, making it, making it. And I think I'm not a potter, but I've tried. It's really hard. It's hard to get it right. It's hard to figure out how tall does it need to be? How thin do the sides need to be? How big does the base need to be? The shape of it, the whole thing, and to make it sort of into this final thing. And so that's sort of the way I write fiction. And so I think, kind of the blob that I started with was this idea of this woman and thinking, I want to tell the story of her whole life. I would say that was kind of my process, which is not very clear, but it's not very clear to me either, probably.
We start with this slice in time, but that's not where the letter writing starts for Sybil. Can we talk about that? Because she, as she explains about her career, The clerkship was my job. The letters amount to who I am. What's the importance of writing for Sybil?
Good question. I don't think it gives anything away to say in the book, you sort of get to a point where she mentions the origin of her interest in letter writing, a letter that she was given as a child. And it is an indicator, I think, in that as you're reading the story, you see how much she values this practice or this discipline or this kind of way of moving through relationships in the world of letter writing. It's her mechanism, it's her vehicle for life and relationships. And in some ways, it's a very beautiful thing. It's a very unique and elegant thing. But on the other hand, it's a tragic thing because by conducting her relationships through letters, she is not conducting her relationships in person, you know, or in a way that's truly intimate. Although in some ways the letters are intimate, but in some ways they are intimate at a distance. You know, there's just something about a letter which you can be home alone and locked in your castle and you can still write a letter, but you're still alone, you know, and I think part of the story is really seeing how in the story you kind of get a window back into her life to see the way that writing letters have been a part of her life sort of from the beginning of, you know, she's a very intelligent sort of precocious child. You sort of see a little bit. I mean, it's just little fragments of these things, but you see that letters are something that she found and clung to for how to move through the world in relationships. And so it's interesting because people have reached out to me following the book to say, I read your book and I've started writing letters to my children or to my friends or, you know, those kinds of things, which is beautiful. And I love that. And I'm a letter writer. But also part of the story is that the letters that she was writing were the tragedy of her life, you know, and there's an aspect of the story, which is that she's going blind. And that's something, you know, from the first page pretty much is that she has this condition that is rendering her blind over time. And so there is something about that that's terrifying for her because she's such a clinger to the practice of letter writing. And, you know, what will she do? How will that impact her life? And, you know, her journey through the book, which is this kind of decade of her 70s and early 80s, it's about her life story, but it is also about the letter writing and what that was and what was beautiful and fulfilling about it. Because some things about it were beautiful and fulfilling, but also what was tragic about it ultimately, and the way in some ways she needed freedom from it. The letter writing vehicle of the story probably became something more than I didn't even really know how it was going to be such a mainstay of the story. I wanted to write a book in letters because I like to read books in letters or different mediums and things like that. But it turned into something more in the story than just the vehicle for the story, I guess.
In addition to writing to friends and family members, Sybil writes to some authors after she's read their books, and she actually has an ongoing reciprocal correspondence with Joan Didion. And as she explains in one of her letters, most often when I wrote, I got a letter back. This surprises people, but I have found that most people write back. Have you found this to be true as well?
I have. Yeah, I have. And I feel like I owe the world an apology for people who were not receiving letters before, but suddenly people are writing to authors. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. sorry if I've caused a tidal wave of letters, but I have had that experience. I have had so many meaningful interactions with people that felt distant from me and above me or high, you know, kind of high in their tower, you know, and I'm down here, a regular person. And writing a letter, I have been moved to receive replies. And just the way that it makes humankind feel even, you know, we're all human. We all walk like our feet walk on the earth. That's common. And so I think there is something very human about writing a letter and receiving a letter back. I think now with the way the world operates with technology, we have these other ways of trying to reach people, you know, through obviously email, but especially I think it becomes sort of cheap or easy through things like Instagram or Twitter or You might be able to send a message through Instagram or comment on something, and that person or their person that runs their social media or whatever responds, and it's a quick endorphin hit of connection, but it is a little cheap, and I'm not saying I haven't done that. And I don't think that there's necessarily a problem with it at its core, but there is something that's not the same as a conversation in person or a letter, I think, in the same way. There's just something about letter writing that's, I don't know, it's a more meaningful point of connection, I guess. And I have had the experience of writing to authors, to artists, to people in kind of higher stations than me and receiving a response. And I think what I love about that, I've actually given this a lot of thought because this question has been kind of brought to me with this book, like, why? What's the point? What does it give you to do that? I think what it gives you is this point of human connection and a moment, a relational connection moment with somebody that you thought was superhuman. It brings everybody down to the same playing field. I didn't do much research, but one thing I did research was the people that I had in the book write back to Sybil. I researched, do these people write back, or did they before they passed away, like Joan Didion or C.S. Lewis or George Lucas? And they do, or they did. And I think that also is a dying, maybe it's a dying thing. Maybe that's a more kind of traditional response, is to receive a letter and write a letter back. But my experience is that I've received really neat replies. And now people are writing to me a lot, like a lot. And I am receiving hundreds of letters, a week. And I am trying to respond, but I actually don't fully have the time to do that. And so I'm feeling a little guilty about that. Like, I started this whole thing and now I can't even keep up with it, but I am doing my best.
Sybil was quite the reader. I wonder if she was endearing to me because the books she mentioned in her letters are some of my favorites. Can I assume that these books hold a special meaning for you too?
Yes, it sounds like you and I, Beth, share a list of favorites. It was very self-indulgent reading list. It was purely, I mean, I wouldn't say purely. There's maybe two or three that are in there because they suit the story moment, but probably the other, I think there's like 50 books mentioned. Probably the other 45 are ones that are my favorites. The sort of Easter egg in the book is that at the very end of the book, there's a letter which is tucked into a book, and that book that it's tucked into is my all-time favorite book.
Rebecca?
That's it, Rebecca. Yeah.
Wow. Philip Roth, yes or no?
Oh,
You don't have to answer.
here's the answer. If that tells you anything,
Well, we don't know if Sybil was a fan either.
we don't.
So I read a physical copy of the book while simultaneously listening to the audio book. It's read through a full cast. And sometimes I would step away from the book, to advance a load of laundry or something, and the audiobook would continue. And when that would happen, and if we would move from one letter to the next letter, I found that I was at a disadvantage because I didn't know who was writing the letter. I mean, sometimes the actor's voice would give it away, but not always. And it reminded me, in a way, of what the poet Billy Collins told me, that if you're listening to his book of poetry on the audiobook, you can't prepare for the ending because you can't see it. Do you think there's some truth to that with letter writing or letter reading, I guess, that it helps to know who the letter is from while you read it?
I thought about this. Someone responded to me at some point about the audiobook and mentioned this idea of how reading the book, they would flip to the end of the letter to see who it was from, and then they would start reading the letter. And I think that's what I would do as well if I was reading it, so I would know. I mean, I think some of the letters were obvious, but I think some of them wouldn't have been. And so it's really interesting to me about this whole experience, specifically with this book about the audio, because by its very nature, this book is a book written to be read because it's a book of letters and you read letters, unless you're a child and someone reads your grandma's letter to you. So it is sort of a, it blows my mind a little bit just to kind of think about this in this way of, is it the same experience for this story to be read aloud? I don't know. I listened to part of it because I wanted to hear what it sounded like, and I was really amazed of the variety of the reading and the voices. I thought they did such a good job. I do, though, not though, period, full stop. They did an amazing job as an audio production. I also do wonder if part of the interactive reading experience that you have with this book can only be had if you're reading it physically. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't have that fully fledged in my mind, but I listen to audiobooks sometimes, and I do enjoy that. But it is a different experience. And I know there's this whole, conversation of, can you say you read a book if you listened to it? I don't really care what you say. I personally say I read this book or I listened to this book because in my brain, I don't think it diminishes necessarily the story, but it is a different way of receiving a story through your ears or through your eyes. And one way that really stands out to me that I had never thought about before, but when I listened to the audio production for a little while of my book, I had this strong feeling of, oh, that's not how I thought Sybil's voice was. I thought her voice was this way in my mind. And then I listened to the audio and I perceived, oh, that's how this actress who did a great job read the book. That's how she perceived Sybil's voice. And so that experience of that even sort of gave me this thought about how when we read a book, is it more of a reader's imagination that brings the story into our minds? Whereas with audio, the voices and the inflections and the pauses and the emotion or lack thereof in their voices takes a little away from what the reader imagines and says, this is what it is. This is how she sounds. This is what she meant. And I thought that was really fascinating because it wasn't the same in my mind as it was in the audio. And so then I thought, it just made me think about audiobooks in general, how it's a different experience. It's a different way of receiving a story, not better or worse, just different, I think.
So, of all the people who wrote to Sybil, do you have a favorite?
I think I'm going to pick two favorites. I so enjoyed her relationship with Baisam, the customer service representative for the online DNA company. It was a relationship I so enjoyed imagining, for all of its flaws and for all of its beauty. I thought it's a relationship that starts off rocky and offensive and hurtful and destructive, and then it becomes something beautiful. I think I just enjoyed that, and I enjoyed some of the humor of that. And I worked in online customer service for a retailer for a few years, and that experience of kind of having people either assume the relationship too much or sort of think you're a robot. Either one is so strange to be on the receiving end of that. So that was a relationship I enjoyed. I also enjoyed how it showed this part of Sybil, this part of her life and character that I enjoyed showing. I enjoyed that we could see that. And then I think probably, the book has so many storylines because each different corresponding partner brings up a different avenue of what's happened in her life or what's happening. There's one part where, because of this online DNA company, she makes contact with someone that's connected to her through DNA. And what that was for the story and what that opened up for Sybil, I felt I was able to give her a gift in what had been a pretty painful life, that she got this sort of amazing gift in the last stretch of her life was, it just felt good and it felt, the letters feel very dear, but not saccharine. I think they just feel good to me, that part of the story.
So my daughters are 28 and 29, and they are in an online book club with a few friends of theirs the same age. My oldest daughter asked, "Do you have a copy of The Correspondent? We're reading it in December for book club." As I mentioned at the top of the show, booksellers and friends of all ages seem to be reading and talking about this book. What makes it so universal in terms of readership?
Beth, do you know the answer to this question? I don't know. It's really baffling and boggling my mind. You know, I wrote this book when I was 34, 35, 36, and it's what I wanted to read. So, you know, I guess I'm kind of in that a little older than them, but in that kind of same demographic. And as I was writing it, I didn't mean for it to be sold, actually. I wasn't thinking I was going to sell this book. So I was kind of just writing it for myself. And then when we did sell it, I thought, oh, I hope that women in their 70s feel like it's right, that I didn't get it wrong. You know, that was really scary to me. More than any other thing, I was worried about that. I didn't really care what reviewers or critics said. I just thought, I hope women in their 70s don't think I, you know, totally mucked it up. And I've had such a good response from people down into their 20s and up through their 90s, you know, to the book. And that has been really neat. And I think, I don't know, is it maybe because it doesn't matter how old she is, that it's kind of the story of life and how life feels and all the different ways that she interacts with people from all walks of life and ages. And her pen pal is this 14-year-old kid, and then she has this other pen pal who's, you know, in their 80s, and it kind of runs the whole gamut. And so I think there's maybe some connection point for anyone, but in some ways, I think ultimately the reason it feels good is because what I wanted to do was tell the story of someone's life in a way that felt true, but also hopeful, you know? And I think that that's what I want to read. Not all the time. I mean, sometimes I want to read something horrible and scary or, you know, or like fantastical, but sometimes I just want to read a book that feels true and hopeful. And I think, you know, the book is ultimately a book about grief and joy and how all of life, everyone's life, all of life is holding grief and sorrow and joy and magic all at the same time. Every minute of every day. I mean, I think about the best moments of my life with my family, with my kids, you know, different moments that stand out as bright beacons of light in my life and memory. During those times, horrible things were also happening. You know, like I think about certain things that happened, but what was also happening in the world or in my family or in my career. Even when beautiful things were happening. And so that whole thing about life, which is that it's just never one or the other, it's sort of always both all the time. And I think that's kind of what the book feels like, is that you're simultaneously happy and euphoric in some ways for her and with her, but at the same time, you're always knowing that also back here is this pain and those things have to coexist and she has to find a way to live through them coexisting. And I think she does find a way. And I think that gives people hope that you can. It's okay to have both. You can survive that, you know, and life can still be sweet.
Well, the book is The Correspondent. Virginia Evans, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Beth. It was great to talk.
The Correspondent by Virginia Evans was published by Crown. On the next Marginalia, we will have a conversation with Patrick Ryan about his novel, Buckeye. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Lou Ann Stevens and Haley Krausen. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.